Paul Polak, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you for having me here.
You started your career as a psychiatrist and spent a number of years, a couple of decades as a psychiatrist, and this somehow influenced the work that you did then with the poor. How did you make that connection between your work with mentally ill and homeless veterans and people in need of psychiatric treatment to then working with the poor?
The reason I got into this space is as a psychiatrist, I was working with major mental illness, the kind of people that normally go to the state hospital. And what we learned very quickly is that their adjustment depended more on their extreme poverty, that is, the members of the population that were chronically mentally ill. Some of them were homeless, and some of them were chronically mentally ill living in the community. Their poverty was a bigger determinant of their adjustment than their symptoms of mental illness. Some people would have active hallucinations while they were working and they were excellent workers. Some people who weren't as flagrantly psychotic seemed to be better adjusted, but they couldn't work worth a lick. So we started doing poverty strategies for the chronically mentally ill living in the community. Things like opening access to Section 8 housing by becoming a housing authority. The state mental health authority could, under a loophole in the law, become a housing authority and apply for Section 8 rent subsidies. So we made Section 8 rent subsidies available to chronically mentally ill people so they could now, under a Section 8, they contribute a quarter of their income, and the HUD subsidy provides a rest. So they were eligible for nice apartment houses with swimming pools. Never had anything like that before in their life. And we used that as a lever to help them move out of poverty because in order to gain entry into that program, they had to agree to move their butt off the sofa watching TV and come in for some kind of work. So we set up a whole system of semi-sheltered work settings, system of residential settings, and access to work and self-esteem and income was the most powerful factor in decreasing readmission rates, for instance. So I was interested in, became interested in poverty strategies and quickly realized that the people who were poor in Southwest Denver were living on $500 or $600 a month, and there were people in Bangladesh living on $30 a month. So I have a lot of curiosity. I went to Bangladesh and talked to those people, much like I did to people who were patients in the mental health system. And they quickly told me in Bangladesh that they were poor because they didn't have enough money. And they made most of their money from farming on small one-acre farms. And what they needed most to earn more income is affordable irrigation. So I talked to a bunch of people all over the place, found that this first a rower pump, which was pumped by a rowing motion, and then a treadle pump was a very effective for affordable irrigation. So I never looked back. I ended up, that was so interesting for me. So we then that led to starting a project to mass market treadle pumps in Bangladesh, which started me on the path of mass marketing affordable irrigation using market creation strategies. We ended up helping 20 million people move out of poverty. And that got me interested in the whole thing about market solutions and business solutions to poverty.
So this, obviously your background and then this one trip to Bangladesh really changed that trajectory. But it's interesting to hear you say, as we were kind of started out saying you're a pioneer in social entrepreneurship. I mean, that really, that concept didn't really exist at the time. But you chose, after this trip to Bangladesh, you chose to employ business and market strategies to fight poverty. Whereas many people choose aid and assistance and other types of strategies to fight poverty. Why is it that a business model and a market strategy and, you know, is preferable or somehow superior to other types of models to fight poverty? Or was there, you know,
I didn't start out with that mindset. I was open to anything. But it's simply that the charity models didn't work with treadle pumps specifically. We started with Rohrer pump, a simple pump like a sump pump with a 2-inch plastic tube and a plunger. And there were 7 or 8 NGOs promoting Rohrer pumps. They usually subsidized either the drilling of the well or the cost of the treadle pump, and the strategy was that poor people are really poor, so they need to have something cheaper. But the mechanism by which you could mass disseminate Rohrer pumps and treadle pumps involved local workshops that made them, dealers who sold them, and well drillers who drilled the well. Now, if you paid for the cost of drilling the well, you put well drillers out of business. And well drillers, there are about 3,000 of them that we trained in Bangladesh, acting in their own self-interest, are much more powerful marketing strategy than paying for the cost of well drilling. If you subsidize the cost of the Rohrer pump or the treadle pump, you put manufacturers out of business. And while that was an advantage to the few people you could subsidize, in the big picture, it really limited the number of people who could get pumps. So the question is, you want to help a few people by paying for their equipment, or do you want to help a million people by activating local entrepreneurial networks to act in their own self-interest to manufacture, market, and install treadle pumps? Obviously, and many experiences I've had, when you give things away, they don't get used properly. So it ended up, based on practical experience, being what I consider to be the most effective way of changing people's lives through access to affordable technologies and strategies. Far more effective than trying to donate people out of poverty.
So providing affordable access and technologies and providing this access, you've largely focused on farmers and farming practices in your work. Is there a particular reason why? Is this just where you got your start? Or, I mean, water in general is where you focus, safe drinking water, safe use of water, but largely so that they can farm and enhance their productivity. And your work has allowed farmers to increase their income by hundreds of millions of dollars if you collectively add it all together. So why farming? Why is that the key area?
IDE, which is the organization that I started, its mission was to increase the income of people who live on a dollar a day. At that time, there were 1.1 billion of those. About 75 or 80% lived on farms. They're primarily rural. And if you look at the 2.7 billion people who live on less than $2 a day, they're primarily rural, not urban. So it was simply started with farmers because that's where population is. And in fact, when you look at the big picture, 85% of all the farms in the world are less than 5 acres. So we get a very distorted view of farming because in the West, we think of kind of farms that exist in the West. They're not typical. On a global scene, farms are small and getting smaller. In the West, they're big and getting bigger. And by the way, that was the focus of IDE. So I founded that organization, led it for 25 years, handed it over. And then now I'm going to the next scale level, because my view is that 20 million people who we help move out of poverty, who are primarily one-acre farmers, that might be a laudable achievement in some eyes, but compared with 2.7 billion people who live on less than $2 a day, which is 40% of the world's population, that's a drop in the bucket. So now I'm moving to the next level of scale, and I'm creating IDE was a nonprofit operating as a business. I'm now in the last 4 years creating global companies, each of which can transform the livelihoods of 100 million $2 a day customers, if the company is successful, generate $10 billion in revenues, and earn enough profits to attract international commercial investment. I'm starting four of those companies. The first is drinking water. The second is affordable electricity for villages. There's more than a billion people without access to safe drinking water, more than a billion people who will never connect to the electric grid. So what we've done there is activate a design team, a global design team, led by space engineers at Ball Aerospace, to cut the cost of photovoltaics by 80%, because photovoltaics are divisible. And so that's a big advantage in dealing with small and large villages and different uses for electricity. A third company that I'm starting creates a green, low-carbon emission competitor to coal and charcoal by transforming agricultural waste and invasive species of plants through a process called torrefaction, which is sort of early pyrolysis. That's a potential $250 billion market. Coal is responsible for 40% of global carbon emissions. We burn 6 billion tons of coal every year on the planet. We produce 4 billion tons of agricultural waste. About a quarter of that is transformable into a thermally competitive alternative to coal. So I think there's a billion tons of ag waste and at least another billion tons of invasive species of plants that could be transformed into a product that competes with coal and charcoal. In the process, that's a $250 billion market. And those ag wastes are located right where the poor people are. So that's very much relevant to poor people. So those are the kinds of companies that I'm starting now. And a group of us are exploring setting up a investment fund. I'm creating four of those companies. I think there's a fairly high risk that at least two or three of them will be successful. Then we're exploring setting up an investment fund of about $130 million that will create 20 more of those companies.
Well, my goodness, there's still an awful lot of work to do. You've taken 20 million people out of poverty, and yet, unfortunately, there's still a lot of people there, and you've got a lot of work to do. Well, I thank you so much, Paul Polak, for being with us today and sharing with us the important work that you're doing. It's very interesting. Thank you very much.
This is one of the quickest 15 minutes I've experienced. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you.